From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, a new study puts a dollar amount on what the opioid epidemic is costing the Massachusetts economy.
A large number of people who overdosed and died were actually employed at the time. So this is something that it's really important for us to have an honest conversation about.
Also, the fight over a recreational pot store in Brookline.
We would be inundated by crushing demand for this mega store. It is the wrong location for this type of store. This is a neighborhood.
And the story of Dr. Joseph Warren, America's forgotten founding father.
Warren rides into the battle, fights in the battle. Revere rides out, gets caught by a British sentry, but we call it Paul Revere's ride. It really should be Dr. Joseph Warren's ride.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. There's new research out today that puts a dollar value on how much the opioid epidemic is costing the Massachusetts economy. The Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation estimates that the state loses more than $2.5 billion, with a B, dollars a year in business productivity. The study found that almost 33,000 people could not work over the last 7 years because of opioid addiction. And of course, that's a major problem when the job market is tight. Joining us to talk about this is Julie Burns, executive director of the nonprofit Rise Massachusetts, which works on dealing with the opioid epidemic, and Rise funded this study. Julie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
So what stood out for you from this research? Were they surprising? Were these numbers surprising at all to you?
I think there's been some national research that has, you know, sort of led us to our interest in finding out what was happening at the state level. So I don't think these numbers are a surprise to many people, but they certainly put all of the information in one place. And I think when you look at all the data together, it can be quite shocking.
As we said at the beginning, more than $2.5 billion a year in lost business productivity. Is that the number that stands out to you? Or what sort of did you look at and say, wow, that's bigger or different than what I thought?
I think the level of absenteeism and presenteeism is so interesting. You know, the number of people who are currently at their desks every day doing their jobs that are either dealing with opioid use disorder themselves or may have a family member who's struggling. We hear stories so often about people who may have had a child who'd overdosed during the night, and they were taken to the ER, and they had to get up and go to work the next day and didn't feel comfortable talking about it in the workplace. So I think the amount of people who are suffering directly and indirectly was a bit of a surprise to me.
So these numbers are not just talking about folks who have a substance use disorder. This is also the family members and the loved ones of those who are struggling as well.
That's absolutely correct.
Mm. How do you measure that exactly? You know, I mean, how do you look at that and measure what folks are going through and how that might be affecting their job performance? It seems like a difficult thing to kind of put a value on.
I think a lot of this was quite difficult to put a value on, and that is one byproduct of this report, is that it highlights the need for better data around this crisis and how it's affecting individuals and their families.
Hmm. What about stigma? I imagine that this is touchy territory here for both employers and employees. On the one hand, you might have employers saying, hey, this isn't really my business. It's not my place. I employ somebody to be productive for me. And if they are productive or appear to be productive, it's not my business what they need to do to get there. And on the other hand, it's an issue of privacy. On the part of an employee who may not want their employer to know about what is going on. And if it doesn't necessarily affect the bottom line, they may think it's none of their employee's business. I mean, how do you sort of walk between those two things?
I think, you know, you're hitting it right on the head. These are really complicated, sticky issues for people. But I think it's important for employers to understand what's happening in their workforce. And they can do that while protecting the privacy of the people that work for them. They can work with their health plan provider to look at de-identified data to identify the prevalence and incidence of OUD in their workplace. They can provide or design employee health benefits that allow people to get the treatment they need while protecting their privacy. And, you know, I think you're right. It's hard for all sides, but given the numbers that we're talking about and the impact that this is having on our workforce and our economy, it's time for everybody to have real honest conversations about this.
Hmm. And what about those businesses that really penalize people if there's any sort of indication that there is substance use at all, let alone a substance use disorder that might require treatment?
Well, you know, I can't speak to the legal sort of part of what employers can and can't do for their employees because it's so specific to each industry. But, you know, people need to be protected, and if they have opioid use disorder, which is a disease, they should be able to seek treatment. They should not be prohibited from treatment, and, you know, opioid use disorder is a treatable disease, and it doesn't preclude people from working.
You know, one of the industries in Massachusetts that's been hardest hit by the opioid epidemic is the fishing industry.
Mm-hmm.
Some estimates in the state suggest that those in the fishing industry are five times more likely to die of an opioid overdose than those in other occupations. And earlier today, we reached out to J.J. Bartlett,
mm-hmm.
who's president of the Fishing Partnership Support Services, and he said his group is doing several things to try to deal with the opioid epidemic and to help people in the fishing industry. And I have a bit of tape that I'd like to play right now that you can listen to. Let's listen.
We've provided 150 fishermen with Narcan training. We've gotten Narcan on 81 vessels. We do ergonomic training so that fishermen can learn how to do their job safely and with fewer injuries. We provide safety and survival training for fishermen. We're designing a smart recovery support group that's run by fishermen for fishermen. And we've also worked with the Coast Guard, who until recently wasn't allowed to carry Narcan on its vessels. And now they are.
So that's J.J. Bartlett with the Fishing Partnership Support Services. Julie, he's talking about what's happening in the fishing industry, but I'm wondering, do you see other industries taking steps like this? And does this study out today make specific recommendations about what businesses might do?
Yes. I think what the Fishing Partnership has done should be considered the gold standard. They clearly understand their constituency, which is quite unique, and had unique needs. And, you know, if you're on a boat and you overdose, you're obviously going to have a solution to that. And I think JJ and his team have figured out how to get Narcan onto boats and train people how to do it. They also have done an amazing job hiring health recovery coaches who can speak to the fishermen, you know, sort of in their own language. They recognize them, they know sort of what they're dealing with every day. So I think that's a great example of how each of these solutions has to be tailored to the specific industry. The Carpenters Union has also done extraordinary work designing programs, you know, through their EAP and also educational programs for job sites. Again, getting Narcan to job sites and getting folks trained on Narcan, and to recognize the signs of overdose so that they can help those folks who are on a job site and may get themselves into trouble.
Julie Burns, Executive Director of RISE Massachusetts. A link to the study detailing the economic costs of the opioid epidemic is available at our website, radioboston.org. Julie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks again.
Well, it's Wednesday, so it's time for our weekly check on the world of sports. And for that, we're joined today by Radio Boston's own Chris Sitterick. Chris, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Deb.
So let's start with the bad news. What happened with the Patriots getting crushed by Tennessee on Sunday?
Yeah, that was a pretty brutal game. They looked pretty bad in all three phases of the game, offense, defense, and special teams. Particularly staggering to me was how bad and how out of sorts the offense looked. They only scored 10 points the entire game. This is an offense that came into the game fourth in the league, averaging about 30 points a game. So that's a real deficiency there. There was also a real just kind of lack of energy that seemed to be across the whole team, and that contributed to how they fell behind early. And you could see that lack of energy really right from the opening play. Titans receiver Darius Jennings took the opening kickoff 58 yards to start the game.
Gostkowski to kick it off. We're underway in Nashville. Jennings, return man, has a touchdown this year on a kickoff return. Jennings finds an angle. Jennings foot race to the perimeter. Tremendous return to open up. Chase by.
So Jennings takes it into Patriots territory. It's a tough way to start the game. Devin McCourty, who finally chased him down, said basically that sucked the energy out of the team, and it was all uphill battle from there. There were also some real personal interests in this. There were a couple of spurned Patriots players on the Titans team. Deion Lewis, the running back, Malcolm Butler, the cornerback, and even the coach Mike Vrabel is not necessarily spurned, but he's a former Patriots player. And I think those guys always have a little bit of extra edge when they come up against Belichick.
So is this just a bump in the road, Chris?
I think so. There are some who are saying that it's a sign of some bigger problems for this team. There was a lot of chaos in the offseason, a lot of kind of swirling palace intrigue. I caught a little bit of Deion Sanders talking on NFL Network about how he thinks the Patriots have a hard time playing from behind. I find that a little hard to believe. Tom Brady is Mr. 28-3, after all. He's the king of comebacks. But he actually, Brady, seemed to echo that sentiment talking to reporters after the game.
Give them a lot of credit. They made a lot of plays, kind of played from ahead. You know, it was right where they wanted to be. We just couldn't do enough early offensively to put any pressure on them, and there was really no pressure on them all day.
And that's really been a trend for the Patriots on the road, especially this year. They're 2-3 on the road, which is not good. Tennessee scored 17 points in the first quarter. Jacksonville back in week two scored 14 unanswered points to open the game. And the Patriots only scored 3 points in the entire first half against the Lions at in Detroit in week three. So 2-3 on the road, not good. And one of those wins is Buffalo. And I think, Deb, even you know, the Bills, not a good team. So that's a little bit of an asterisk there.
Well, let's just go back to Brady for a moment. I mean, does this lack of energy in this game, you know, everyone's looking, you know, are these signs that Brady's finally maybe past his prime?
I'd be more willing to give you that if we hadn't been asking that question the last 5 years or so. He is 41 years old. Eventually, he's going to hit the wall. I don't think this is necessarily it. He looked bad on Sunday. I will give you that. He didn't throw for any touchdowns, but he was sacked 3 times. He was hit 6 times. Brady has consistently over his career been a guy, when he is pressured, when he's feeling the defense around him, he kind of starts to bob and weave a little bit. He gets the happy feet. He kind of loses that focus a little bit, as most quarterbacks do. If you got 300-pound guys rushing at you, it's hard to kind of stay focused on your receivers. So I would write it off as just a bad game. This team has been there too many times before.
Okay. Let's turn to another team that's had some struggles this season, Celtics. I know people were excited for this year. How do you
think me too.
How do you think this season's been going so far?
Been a bit of a mixed bag, unfortunately. They're 7-6 to start the year. Everybody kind of assumed they were going to run away with the Eastern Conference. Right now, they're fifth in the standings. The big change here from last year, you've got Gordon Hayward, who's back from that absolutely horrible leg injury that happened in game one of the season last year. And so because he's back, he's a prominent player. He's taking a lot of minutes and a lot of touches. You've got the young guys who had stepped up last year, now seeing their roles diminished a little bit. Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum. And I think there's a little bit of a feeling out period going on right now. Also, this is a team that came into the season, as I said, with really high expectations. When you've got a young core, I think that can mess with your mind a little bit.
And so, you know, last year the Celtics had so much success. I mean, what do you think's going on here? Why haven't they lived up to, you know, sort of rode that wave all the way into this season?
Yeah, it's a little bit of growing pains, which I guess is not that uncommon with young guys. As I said, this is a young core that is really starting to try to figure each other out with the addition of Gordon Hayward. Kyrie Irving, who's been maybe the most consistent lone bright spot for this team this year, he says that a lot of the problems they've been having really comes down to attitude.
We're not as good as we think we are. That's really what it comes down to. I think I said in the beginning of the season, the excitement is just done. You know, it's real basketball now, so it's not just about the potential of the team or where we'll be at the end of the season.
So some pretty strong words there. We're not as good as we think we are. He's obviously trying to send a message to his teammates. You know, compare this team to last year's team. Last year, once Gordon Hayward goes down in game one, all expectations kind of out the window. The pressure's off. So the team starts 0-2 and then wins 16 in a row. This year they come in, they're a heavy favorite in the East, and now they're 7-6, really kind of struggling to get that cohesion.
Okay, well, let's try to do a positive story here. How about those Red Sox, World Series champs? You have some good news about the Red Sox.
You're killing me, Deb, because here I am once again raining on your parade a little bit. Alex Cora was in the running for American League Manager of the Year. You would think 108 wins, most in Red Sox franchise history. He had it in the bag. That award was given instead to Bob Melvin, who's the manager of the Oakland Athletics.
So just for a minute, say you were not from New England. Was this the right call?
I think you can make a case either way here. It's an interesting question. First of all, the postseason doesn't count. This is an award they vote on at the end of the regular season. And I think if you were able to look at all of those amazing postseason decisions that Cora made, then he would absolutely have walked away with this thing. There's also an expectations here. The Red Sox were supposed to be one of the best teams in the league, if not the best team. The Oakland Athletics weren't even necessarily supposed to make the playoffs. You look at payroll. The Oakland A's, $66 million for their entire payroll. The Red Sox come in at $234 million. Mm. So a huge discrepancy there. And this tends to be an award that goes to small market teams with kind of that lower budget.
Yeah, we didn't need that award anyway.
That's right. We got the important trophy. That's okay. The one that makes us home here.
Well, I'm not going to let you leave until you do give us something really positive here that we can smile about.
That's fair enough. And so I do have something for you, actually.
Okay.
So I want to take a moment here to appreciate Willie O'Ree. He's a former Boston Bruin. He became the first black player in the NHL when he entered a game in Montreal on January 18th, 1958. He was actually a guest on Radio Boston. He spoke with Meghna Chakrabarty back in 2016 when he was featured in a film called Soul on Ice, Past, Present, and Future. And just listen to how he described the actual game where he broke the color barrier.
So when I come up and stepped on the ice, on January the 18th, there was no big recognition. Nobody was said, oh, there's Willie O'Ree. He broke the color barrier. And it really didn't realize with me until the next day I read it in the paper.
What'd you think?
Well, I felt good, but, my main concern was to just play a good game.
Yeah.
and help the Bruins win.
So pretty crazy. He's breaking the color barrier, doesn't even realize it, just wants his team to win. But that was pretty indicative of the type of player that Willie O'Ree was. He officially was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame on Monday. So congrats to Willie O'Ree and his family.
Okay. Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, the fight over recreational marijuana in Brookline. We'll take your calls. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Recreational marijuana stores are just about to open in Massachusetts 2 years after state voters approved legalizing recreational pot. But these openings don't mean the fight over marijuana has ended. In fact, in some communities, it's just beginning. We want to spend some time now talking about the rollout of recreational marijuana. First, we want to take a look at what's happening in Brookline, where some residents are concerned about a proposal for a pot store. Paul Warren is among them, and he joins us in studio. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this. Are there plans in your community for a recreational cannabis store? Are you supporting those plans or are you opposed? And did you vote to support legalizing recreational marijuana a few years ago? You can call us with your thoughts, your comments at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Paul Warren, let's start with you. You've led an effort against a proposal from the company Ascend Massachusetts.
That's correct.
And that's for a store on Beacon Street in Brookline. And we should say that this site on Beacon Street was where Waxy's Modern Irish Bar was.
That's right.
For those folks who might know about it. So why are you opposed to this proposal?
Well, the St. Mary's community knows that it's wrong to locate a 6,000-square-foot recreational marijuana megastore in its highly residential area. I'm sure you've been down in this area since you know Waxy's. It's a high-density neighborhood. There's condos. There's apartments. There's a lot of families and professionals. There are a lot of kids. There's 13 different institutions in the area that house K through 12 children, different programs. And there's a tiny little block of stores. It's a strip that runs from Carlton Street down to St. Mary's Street. And this Waxy's storefront is the largest retail location that where they would actually drop in this megastore. It would be right in the heart of the district.
So is it the size then? You've mentioned 6,000 square feet more than once. Is it, if it were smaller, would it be okay?
You know, so right now we are focused on the proposal that's been made to us by Ascend, that's been put in by them. So we've been evaluating that. We don't have another proposal in front of us, which would be a smaller store at a different location. We've really done all of our analysis and discussion with the community around that large store.
So it's just size then. I mean, and right size now, because...
Right now we are super focused on the current application that's been put in by Ascend. That's what we're focusing on.
Because you think what would happen if this store comes in? What are the problems that you think would...
Well, sure. So, the first thing is that this would be one of the largest stores in Massachusetts. It's actually 6,200 square feet. I think they'll have 5,000 square feet that's actually used for the retail establishment. But, you know, this is a family neighborhood. It's a family district. It's highly congested as a neighborhood. And we have this very small strip of stores. And to, you know, drop in a retail marijuana store into the heart of that district, I say district, it really is just a block of stores, we're going to see a tremendous influx of outside traffic, foot traffic, parking into the area. We know that there are 60,000 college students within walking distance of this store. We know that there are 81 Red Sox home games, and God bless them when they go into the postseason. And, you know, we have all the great concerts at Fenway Park. They're now going to have a year-round concert venue. This is going to put tremendous pressure onto a neighborhood that has a very small business district that already is overburdened by all these activities going on, plus there's no parking. So it really is going to be a pretty dramatic change for us.
But would traffic and parking still be issues regardless of what goes into a 6,000-square-foot facility?
Sure. I think if Walmart came in and proposed a store, you'd get the same response. I think Pepe Pizza's was proposed at one point. You know, the issue is our one-teeny block of stores is really geared towards to serve the local community. It's an L district. That's the zoning in Brookline. Mm-hmm. That means it's meant to serve the neighborhood. And Ascend cannot support their revenue model. They're going to have $6 million potentially in revenue the first year. That's going to require 76,000 customer visits. We've overlaid health and human service data over the demographics of our neighborhood. And we know that 3-5% of Ascend's customer base will come from the local neighborhood. The rest of it's going to have to come from outside. That's going to be an influx of tremendous demand into our neighborhood. It's a family neighborhood, and completely change the nature of that area.
You know, how is it different from other plans that have come forward in Brookline? I'm assuming, there's also New England Treatment Access, or NETA.
Yep.
It is opening soon.
I used to live next to it.
Right near Brookline Village, or in Brookline Village, I believe their recreational cannabis store is. I mean, if you look at data for what their revenue model might be, and obviously you probably haven't done it, so you probably don't know exactly if it's still going to be only a small percentage of locals who would actually support the business and therefore allow the company to achieve its revenue projections. But I'm assuming it would be similar. So does it matter really where it's located then?
So, you know, the one thing I can speak to, I'm not a zoning specialist in Brookline by any stretch of the imagination. I haven't assessed and analyzed every one of the locations that have been proposed. We've really been focusing on the specific location that's being proposed to us in our little neighborhood on our little residential block. But what I can say is there is no other proposed or in place marijuana, either medical or retail or cultivator, that has been opposed to the extent that this is being opposed. We had 300 to 350 people come out to the community meetings. We have 760 signed letters to the select board. Mm-hmm. This has been 2 weeks, 3 weeks. It's happened very quickly. Mm-hmm. There is overwhelming opposition. I don't believe that of the 180 or so marijuana, retail, medical, or cultivators in the state, that anything has come close to this level of opposition. So I think that each specific location needs to be evaluated on its own merits. What's the impact? What's going to be happening?
Well I think there may be a lot of opposition, but, you know, some folks might say the company itself is complying with local zoning rules. That town meeting did say that these recreational marijuana shops could go into local business districts in Brookline. That was a specific town meeting vote that was approved. The company, Ascend Massachusetts, is following all local protocols. It's following the rules. So couldn't there be some sort of compromise reached with the folks who have concerns that some of your concerns about traffic and other things might be mitigated to be able to, allow this to happen?
Right. So I hear what you're saying. I think the first thing I'd like to address is the statement that Ascend has been following all the process and everything like that. That's true to the absolute minimum. At the first community meeting that we attended to, we had 130 people show up. They had 16 chairs. So, you know, one issue is that there's been no opposition to these things. If you look at Brookline, you know, none of the sites have been opposed this way. So I think they were kind of caught off guard. But we've been asking for just a transparent process. You know, how can a community evaluate the impact of such a significant change, a significant size store into their small retail district without information? At that first community meeting, they made commitments to give us their business plans, their marketing plans, their customer segmentations, their traffic study. We don't know. And the second meeting, they came and said, "Sorry, we're not going to provide that. You can get it at the Cannabis Commission level." So I would just argue that, you know, there's a difference between complying and being a partner with the community. And Ascend Mass is not a partner with St. Mary's community at all.
Well, we did reach out to Ascend to ask them about this particular controversy and the level of opposition. We spoke with Andrea Cabral. She's the CEO of Ascend Massachusetts. She's also the state former public safety secretary, and she served as an advisor to the State Cannabis Control Commission. And Cabral told us, we have a little bit of tape here that we want to play from her, that while there might be opposition to this proposed store on Beacon Street in Brookline, she believes that the company will be able to eventually operate peacefully there. Let's listen.
I understand people who are against it. No matter what we say, there's nothing that I can do to change their minds. I'm not attempting to do that. People are entitled to their opinion. But it's a neighborhood of 3,500 people. Brookline voted at 60% for legalization. Retail sales are part of legalization. And I assume that what will happen here will happen the same, you know, will follow sort of the same pattern as we've seen with other types of businesses that have been protested. I believe, you know, Netta, which has the medical marijuana dispensary, was protested initially. And there have been other types of businesses that have been protested. And, you know, they end up largely not having incidents.
So Paul Warren, Andrew Cabral says, you know, these other businesses have operated peacefully, and they'll probably be able to, too. Your response?
So I would first say that I lived next to Netta before I moved to my current location, and I was there for 7 years. When Netta opened up, Netta is a fine operation. I have no issues with Netta. I actually sat through the select board meeting the other night when they had their licensing hearing. There was not a single person in opposition, by the way. Not a single person came to the Netta hearing in opposition. If we had a similar hearing, I would assure you that there would be a sea of red hats in the room and probably out the hallway and down the elevator in opposition. So, you know, each location needs to be assessed on its merits and the impact on the community and also the provider coming in. The St. Mary's neighborhood knows that dropping a 6,200 square foot retail marijuana shop into the heart of its little business district that is maybe 15 stores is going to be unstable. It's going to destabilize the neighborhood, and it's not sustainable at all. We're very, very concerned about that. The last thing I would say is about, you know, Netta going, well, Netta's done a good job. But I lived in a condominium complex near Netta. 78 units. When Netta went in, you know, God bless them. I think they probably have got some things doing right now. But we had to put up $30,000 worth of security gates and security access because the smoking behind our building, marijuana, went way up.
I want to be able to take some calls here.
Sure,
Jessica is calling from Brookline. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi. I just kind of feel, now, I'm not a marijuana smoker. I have no interest in it. But I just feel like it's time, it's here, it's been voted for, and I think it just seems like no matter where they choose to put it, there's going to be excuses for not putting the shop there, and I think we need to get out of our own way and stop claiming, you know, not in my backyard.
Okay. Jessica, thanks for the call. Paul Warren, what do you say to folks who say this is really just NIMBYism? Did you vote to support legalizing recreational marijuana?
I did not.
You did not. Mm-hmm. So, but most of the town of Brookline.
Yeah.
Did.
So, you know, our position is that we're not against marijuana in the town. You know, the town, 59% of the town actually said that they supported recreational marijuana. What we are saying is that this is the worst possible location that you could put it. There's so much opposition. There's something wrong here. If you went to the other community meetings for the three other locations, the one in Coolidge Corner, the two on Com Ave, even if you went to the license hearing in Fendetta, there was no opposition. So we had 350 people show up at two community meetings. One was on 2 days' notice. The other one was on a week's notice. And there was, out of those 350 people that showed up, there were three people that were supporting it. Mm. So it's, you know, I don't know how you explain that other than the community is wildly opposed to it.
Well, you know, we reached out to the select board in Brookline earlier today, and we spoke with Neil Wyszynski, the chair of the select board, and we asked him about this. We started by asking him about the opposition to this proposal. I want you to hear some of this conversation.
Sure. Last week, we were presented with quite a few letters of opposition.
Hundreds of letters, I'm told. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a pile.
Huh.
Pretty high pile.
Hmm. Now this
brought in on a two-wheeler.
Well, yeah, that's a lot of letters. This is one of five proposed recreational cannabis stores in Brookline. You have four community host agreements that you can give out. So somebody's not going to get it.
We have four licenses that we can give out.
Have you seen any kind of opposition like this to the other proposals that have come forward?
Not like this.
So if we go to what Ascend is proposing in terms of Brookline, so far is it in compliance with at least the regulations for recreational cannabis companies?
As far as I know so far, but there's a lot of process that still has to happen, including going to the State Cannabis Control Commission, and there's a whole qualification process.
Will all of this opposition affect what the board does in terms of making a decision on who might eventually get a license?
You know, we have to listen to the opposition and listen to the points they're raising and see if any of the points are valid and can be mitigated. You know, for example, there's little parking around the site. So, you know, I really want to hear what the plan is and how they're going to deal with it. A couple of markers that really weigh on me is, first, when question four, the marijuana question, was put to the voters, in this particular precinct, 60% of the voters voted yes. Additionally, in town meeting last year, when we were voting on where to allow these kinds of retailers in town, there was an explicit question on whether or not we should allow marijuana retailers in local business districts. And town meeting said, yes, we should allow it. So, you know, town meeting actions have consequences. Elections have consequences. So we have to listen to those voices. But we also have to listen to the voices in the neighborhood.
What about money? Under the agreement with NETA, New England Treatment Access, Brookline gets 3% of the company's gross sales, and NETA will donate $25,000 a year to a nonprofit that's been approved by the town. I mean, that's some pretty significant amount of money. I mean, is that what the select board expects will be sort of a standard financial agreement with any marijuana company that wants to come into Brookline?
That has been the pattern. So you know, we have a lot of needs that this could go towards.
What do you say to folks who say, is this just NIMBYism here? I mean, Brookline, as you pointed out, voted to approve decriminalization. And there are voters in Brookline saying, yeah, we want recreational marijuana legal, just so long as it's sold someplace else other than Brookline.
Well, you know, that really hasn't been the picture throughout Brookline. There's been little opposition to the other locations. I think, you know, this particular location has some difficulties.
And do you think that there might be better locations in town for this type of business?
I don't know. You know, town meeting has spoken at, so, you know, we follow the law.
All right. Neil Wyszynski is chair of the Select Board in Brookline. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. And now we're back in the studio with Paul Warren, Brookline resident. I wonder, when you hear Neil Wyszynski say, yes, there is definitely a lot of opposition to this proposal for a recreational marijuana shop on Beacon Street, but the Select Board has to balance what everyone is saying here. What do you say to that? And what do you say to folks going forward here about, you know, is there or are there any steps that could be taken for this particular
When Neil was speaking, a visual came into my head. You're probably familiar with it. Back in 1989, there was a gentleman who stood in front of three tanks in Tiananmen Square. Now, this isn't a perfect analogy because that was against totalitarianism and, you know, taking people away in the middle of the night. But I see that gentleman as a neighborhood that is very concerned. The first tank is Ascend, going after sales. The second tank is the town going after taxes. And the third tank is corporate marijuana going after profits. That's the visual that I have, and that's what I think Neil's talking about.
Brookline resident Paul Warren, who opposes a recreational marijuana store in Brookline on Beacon Street, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, the little-known story of the man once called the greatest incendiary in all of America. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. If you were asked, who is the man known as the greatest incendiary in all of America and one of the earliest activists in the American Revolution? Chances are you may not have the right answer. He is Dr. Joseph Warren, who led the groundwork for American independence at a time when many colonists were opposed to armed rebellion. Our next guest, historian Christian Despina, has gone through a variety of documents to bring Dr. Warren's story to light. It's outlined in the new book titled Founding Martyr, The Life and Death of Dr. Joseph Warren, the American Revolution's Lost Hero. Christian Despina, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So while many people may not know who Dr. Joseph Warren is, why should we put him with the likes of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson?
Well, in my humble estimation, before there was George Washington, there was Dr. Joseph Warren. So when Joseph Warren is killed at the Battle of Bunker Hill on June 17, 1775, Washington has just been appointed general of the Continental Army about 3 days before. Now, at that point, Washington had been a retired colonel of the Virginia Regiment. So it's been almost 20 years since he's been involved in a military conflict. So when he arrives in Cambridge, he has to fill Dr. Joseph Warren's shoes. There's primary source letters from soldiers involved in the Battle of Bunker Hill that are writing, a new general arrived today, not mentioning Washington by name. And the few letters that do mention Washington by name say, who is this General Washington? We have never heard of him before. Mm-hmm. And just to put it in perspective, John Adams had written a letter basically saying, I had never heard the name George Washington before. Who is this man? Huh. So really, this is Washington will become Washington, but at this point, he's not well known. He's known in Virginia. He's not really known in the rest of the colonies. He really has to step in and fill that role that Dr. Joseph Warren has left behind.
Hmm. So Warren, who is he? He's born in Roxbury in 1741.
Right.
And how did he become such a revolutionary?
Well, this is an amazing part of the story because by all rights, when you read the documents and the letters, by all rights, he should have cast his lot with the Loyalists. He's getting a lot of political patronage from the Loyalists and the Tories, but he does cast his lot with the Patriot Whigs. And really, the people who do recognize the name, oh yeah, Dr. Joseph Warren, he was killed at the Battle of Bunker Hill. But it overshadows the 10 years of resistance activities against these oppressive crown policies by the British. And people don't know really what he was involved with for those 10 years, from the Stamp Act riots to the Townsend duties to the Boston Massacre, the Tea Party, the battles of Lexington and Concord, the skirmishes at Noddle's Island, Grapes Island, and Bunker's Hill. All that basically gets washed away from this one afternoon.
Hmm. Tell me what it was about his story that motivated you to want to dig deeper.
I first came across a book, and it was written in 1835, and it was written actually by his niece. And I started reading it thinking, wow, so this fellow delivers two Boston Massacre orations. He's performing autopsies. He's part of a three-man committee writing the short narrative of the horrid massacre at Boston. He's writing these incendiary, polemical articles in the newspaper. He's fighting in these battles. He's president of the Provincial Congress, head of the Committee of Safety. He's involved in the Boston Tea Party, helping to plan it. He becomes a Grand Master of the Scottish Rite Masons in North America. And
all this stuff, and you never heard
right,
of him.
Right. We don't know who he is.
Right.
And he's really a footnote in history, and it's a shame.
Yeah. So tell us, you know, tell us a little bit more. You listed some of those accomplishments. And one of the things that you said that it was a story that's in the book that I thought was interesting is that in 1775, he volunteered to give the annual speech commemorating the Boston Massacre. And even though British soldiers threatened to assassinate him, he did, but he did so in a colorful way.
Right. And
what did he do?
So British soldiers are threatening to assassinate anyone who delivers that oration. And he volunteers to do it when no one else does. And not only does he deliver the oration, but he arrives and wears a toga while he's delivering the oration. And, you know, it's easy to look at this event with 21st century eyes and say, okay, he came through it unscathed, but he really didn't know. And part of the amazing thing is before he delivers this oration, he sees five patients that day. So it almost seems like he's unnerved by all this, but he arrives, he delivers the oration. And at
In a toga.
And really after that, one British officer refers to Dr. Warren as the greatest incendiary of all America, as you stated at the beginning. Mm. But even high-powered loyalists like Thomas Hutchinson and Peter Oliver. Peter Oliver says about Dr. Joseph Warren, had he lived, the name Washington would have been in obscurity.
Wow.
Thomas Hutchinson says if Warren had survived, he would have been the Cromwell of North America. And these are high-powered loyalist, powerful, socially connected families saying this about Dr. Joseph Warren.
Describe what Boston was like, because when you're talking about this, you know, what's happening here? It sounds like there was a lot of chaos, and it was maybe a really tense time. Like, what kind of a picture would you paint for people, briefly, about what Boston was like when Dr. Warren was around?
British troops are constantly arriving in Boston, and at one point, there's as many British soldiers in Boston, occupying Boston, as there are adult white males. But Boston was just as nasty and dirty as you might expect it would have been back then. I mean, right. We see from some of the primary source journals that Warren's buying things like penis syringes to treat sexual diseases. There's a lot of prostitution. It was a very, very tense situation to have what was supposed to be our allies, our mother countries, our brothers, these British soldiers stationed in the colony. So it almost became like a standing army that was our enemy. This is what it started to be viewed as. And this is what started a lot of street fights, tarring and feathering. This is what led to the Boston Massacre. And that's when it really started to come to a head and become a powder keg.
Describe for me the role of the Masons and why that was important.
This was important because the Masons were a fraternal, charitable organization. And when Warren leaves Harvard, he goes back to the Roxbury Farm. And he's kind of removed from, I don't want to say civilization, but he's sort of on the outskirts of things. But then he joins the Masonic organization, St. Andrew's Lodge. Paul Revere was a member. John Hancock was a member of St. Andrew's. So this put Warren in touch with future patriots from the Whig organizations. You could start to see at this point Warren is really branching out and making social connections and networks that will be pivotal.
Speaking of two things from that, spy network.
Mm-hmm.
You have evidence that you sort of had the spy network going on at the
yes.
time as well. So describe that.
So We have a quote from Revere talking about how himself and 30 other mechanics organized themselves to spy on British troop movements and report their actions to one or two people, including Dr. Joseph Warren. But in the spring of 1775, most of these Whig patriots are on their way to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. So Warren really becomes the on-the-ground leader of the revolution. Undoubtedly, Dr. Joseph Warren is at the head of an intricate system where this spy information is being filtered to him, and he's acting on it. Hmm. And this would lead to the Paul Revere's ride.
Right. So Paul Revere's midnight ride, really? Should it be called Warren's midnight ride?
Yes, it should be called Dr. Joseph Warren's ride. And I hope Revere fans aren't going to be angry with me, but it's Dr. Joseph Warren's intelligence network that leads him to dispatch Revere and Dawes on the midnight ride. And even more incredibly, that next morning, Warren rides out into battle and is fighting in the hottest part of the battle in Arlington, and almost gets killed when his hairpin is shot out from the side of his head. It's just ironic that it's Warren's intelligence. Warren rides into the battle, fights in the battle. Revere rides out, gets caught by a British sentry, but we call it Paul Revere's ride. It really should be Dr. Joseph Warren's ride. Mm.
And then came the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Right.
Yeah. What happened?
So the way I'd like to say it would almost be as if the president would get in a tank and start fighting maybe in Iraq or Afghanistan. It was so incredulous that Dr. Joseph Warren would volunteer and fight in this battle. He's nominated a major general 3 days before, a major general of the provincial army. And he arrives at the battle on the morning of June 17th and asks, where is going to be the worst part of the fighting, because that's where I want to be. Now, the British make 3 attempts to get over the redoubt where the Patriots are. And in the third assault, they're successful. They climb the walls of the redoubt, and Warren is killed as he's trying to direct his men to the only escape route. He's shot through the face, and people don't hear about this for days. It's rumors. We don't know if Warren's killed. Was he captured? Was he even at the battle? One of the British generals say, if his death is true, it's worth 500 of my most skilled soldiers. Huh. There's primary source letters from both British and American sides of the battle documenting that when the British did come over the redoubt, that they executed any wounded provincial soldiers, they bayoneted them with their bayonets, and they beat their heads in with the breeches of their guns. So there is no question that Dr. Warren's body was mutilated.
Hmm. So how do you think his death first affected the revolution?
So this is a time in the 18th century where there's no superheroes or actors. The heroes of that day were either nobility or their military heroes. So when Warren is killed, he really becomes the first American martyr. And the colonists look to him as a hero. And you see all these elegies and poems being published after he dies referring to him as the godlike Warren. But again, it's sort of a catch-22 because his martyrdom overshadows his importance and his on-the-ground grassroots political activism that drove the colonies to independence.
Why do you think we've forgotten this history?
I think, you know, I'll put it in perspective. Warren's killed when he's 34. He dies a year before the Declaration of Independence is declared. He basically dies as a treasonous subject of King George III. He's not part of this later triumphalist phase of the American Revolution. My whole point of this book was to try and put some flesh on this marble statue of Joseph Warren.
Well, are there areas today in Boston where we can see his influence?
I think you can look at the Bunker Hill Monument, the obelisk. There's a Bunker Hill Monument Museum across the street. You can see his painting in Museum of Fine Arts, Boston. But I think his influence is all around the country because I don't think it's a bold claim to say that really without him, the Whig movement in Boston might have faltered and possibly ended in failure, because at this time, Boston is a microcosm of the colonies, and the events that are happening in Boston are so pivotal, and he's involved in every single event that really without him, I don't know exactly how things would have played out. I mean, it's nice to guess and kind of look back, but he was so pivotal.
Hmm. So right now, at the end of 2018, is there a lesson or two that you think can be learned from Dr. Warren?
Yes, I think just his grassroots political activism and that dedication to what he believed in and the ideals of liberty and virtue and freedom, he really was more than just words. So not only does he deliver these orations, but he's writing these articles, he's fighting on the battlefield, and he really is an inspirational figure because he actually said what he meant and he did what he said he was going to do. Yeah. And he didn't just...
There's a lesson.
Right. And he didn't just sit behind a desk and let other people do it for him. He actually did it with action.
Right. Okay. Well, historian Christian Despina's new book is titled Founding Martyr, The Life and Death of Dr. Joseph Warren, the American Revolution's Lost Hero. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.